This is the United States Eventing Association's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On the show this week, as Kelly Maylock from Area 4 in Wisconsin thinks about this year's event in September, she talks about what it's been like to host their first event last year at Sundance Farm. But first, Rob Burke, the Chief Operating Officer at the USEA, joins us to explain how the entry fees are spent. Rob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Chris.
I'm sure there isn't a member that doesn't ask that question. Where do the entry fees go?
You know, I've been asking the same question myself since I began competing. I don't want to say exactly how many years ago, but it was a long time ago. And I think everybody always asks, you know, why are the prices this high? And they've been asking that in perpetuity, I think, since the beginning. And it's really interesting to take a look at it and compare the numbers to the way they were, say, 20 or more years ago.
So why don't you unpack the myths of entry fees, Rob?
Sure. So, you know, what an entry costs, as we all know, varies from competition to competition, from the level you're competing at on. And there's also a couple of other fees that you'll typically see in addition to just a simple entry fee. You'll see both an entry fee. If you're going to be stabling and staying on for more than one day, then you have that stabling fee. But those are typically the two main fees that we see on any omnibus listing for an event. So when you register, you pay those associated fees. So actually breaking those down, you get to take a look at, or we've been able to take a look at what each organizer actually has to pay to run that event. And there's a disparity. It costs a lot of money to run these events, but people from the outside, seldom do you think about all the intricacies and what those costs are. We know, because of a good Lloyd's of London study that was done for the years 2009 to 2014, that the average entry fee, and that's not stabling, just an entry fee in the U.S., was about $158 for those years. And just out of interest, I took a look at what the average entry fee for all the events running this upcoming weekend were. And it looked like the average was somewhere around $200, so a little more than the average over the last 5 years, but still in the general range of cost. At the same time, while the Lloyd's of London study didn't look at the stabling costs this upcoming week range somewhere from $45 up for the weekend. I mentioned earlier that it's interesting to look at 20 years ago, and that's about the last time I was really actively competing, Chris. And I looked at an event that I went to in 1995, and interestingly, the cost to compete at that event in Area 6 was only about $40 less than it is today, 20 years later. So if you think in terms of what the cost of anything from gas, which has doubled over the last 20 years, to household incomes, which have actually gone up by at least a third, the costs of actually competing in that event haven't kept pace. They've actually stayed relatively low in the grand scheme of things. Margie Malloy and Ken Sexton developed a really good study of this back in 2011 that they presented at the USEA annual convention, and Christina Gray did a follow-up. So where does that $150 average fee go and stabling? Well, it's across the board. I mean, you can think about the big costs that you won't necessarily see on that entry fee necessarily, like the cost of the land to purchase. The people who run these events, whether the organizer owns the land, whether the organizer is leasing the land, there is always a cost associated with having that land. Seldom do you have, you know, a piece of land that was just turned over for free. So, you know, I can look at it personally from when the USA runs the American Eventing Championships, we have paid a fee to utilize the property on which that event is held. So that's one of the very first and probably the biggest expenses you have to fold into that entry, or what the cost is as an organizer to run that event. Beyond that, you think about everything from building the cross-country course. And in their study, they actually found that the average jump from design to construction can run about $1,500 each. So if you're talking about running an event with, say, beginner novice through preliminary, you're talking about 100 fences. So it's about $150,000 to build the cross-country courses associated with those events. And then on top of that, you have everything from the cost to pay your officials, which can range from about 20, it's somewhere in the neighborhood with travel costs and everything else, about $2,500 per official. And I think at base minimum, there are about 5 officials that every event needs to have per the rules to be able to operate, from the TD to the president of the grand jury to the dressage judge, you name it. And that doesn't really even take into account the safety coordinator, the scorer. You also will need a course designer. So with $2,500 per official, it adds up really quick. If you've got a base minimum of 5 officials, I mean, right there, you're over $10,000 pretty quickly. There are all sorts of other expenses, from paying for an EMT to be on site, which can run everything somewhere between $250 to $400 a day, to having, you have to have a vet on ground during the jumping section, and those prices vary, to farriers. So in all, when all of these costs were taken into account, they found that, really conservatively speaking, not including costs with stabling or equipment or facility fees, utilities or repairs, that the cost per organizer per rider, so for that organizer just to put on that competition for one rider, is about $235. So pretty quickly you can see the disparity. When you've got an average of $150 entry fee and the organizer needs to come up with $230 just to pay to put on that event for that rider, there's this huge disparity. So where do we make it up with? Our organizers have done a great job of doing things like bringing in sponsors, getting grants, you name it, anything they could do to come up with this extra money so that they could keep those prices low. But in all, Chris, it's nobody has said that. I seldom do I hear anybody say that keeping horses is cheap. And if they do, they haven't done it for very long. But in the end, I think a lot of credit goes to our organizers for having kept the prices as low as they have over the last 20 or more years.
And those overheads will always be there, depending on the level of competition as to how much is invested in jumps, for example, Rob. I mean, it goes exponentially, doesn't it, with the increase in divisions and the level of those divisions?
It does. It really does. And from a course perspective, it's never a case of you build the course and it just stays put and it'll be there for a number of years. No, I mean, we all know that there's change out. You have to put in new jumps. You have to repair old jumps. So, it is. It's constant cost associated with it. And one of the things that I've always preach to people who are keeping stables, which is, there are some similarities, is that there's a way that you can run your stable if it's like a boarding operation or an instructional facility. There's a way that you can run your facility that you could stay just above water and yet the facility is crumbling around you. And the same goes to be said for these events. A competition organizer, a property owner, they could run the event at base minimum and have the event go off, but at the same time, the facilities could be breaking down. And these costs, they never go away. They're always there. They keep increasing over time, unfortunately.
And the challenge remains, of course, of finding sponsorship dollars and grants to underwrite some of those expenses.
Yeah, it is. It's a tough. There aren't. There are some really good organizers out there who have been trying to look outside the box to bring in new sponsors and engage new interests. You know, I think of a couple of events that, like Carolina does a good job of it. Obviously, Rolex is kind of the granddaddy of them all. We've tried to do it with the AAC and others, Rebecca. We've tried to create an atmosphere where spectators would be interested in coming, people who might never want to event themselves, but they want to come and have a good time. And in doing that, they've been able to bring in a new set of sponsors. You know, we've got some amazing sponsors. I could run through the list of some of our USCA sponsors and some of our event sponsors that have gone above and beyond to support the sport, and they are also at the same time they are marketing their products to our sport, but they only have so much money, and at the end of the day we need to attract new sponsorship dollars. But you know, for this little tiny event that isn't necessarily trying to bring in the spectators, that's a whole nother ball game. So for them it's even harder when they're not necessarily looking to put on a world-beating, international-level event. Attracting the spectators is a little harder, and then attracting sponsorship dollars is a little harder.
So. And we've heard on recent podcasts, Rob, too, about some of the creative ways that you can involve the whole family, and therefore you've got a volunteer base there that is building continually, on which so many rely on within the local community.
Yeah, volunteers... if volunteers did not exist, if you think of all the people that it takes to judge a cross-country course, if we did not have those volunteers, I don't know of many events in the world, let alone our country, that would still be able to run. Because if you think of having to pay and instruct and educate folks on how to do that job for every one of those fences, it's cost prohibitive. So beyond that, I mean, you think of the ring stewards, the bit checks, you know, the scribes, that we've gotten to a point where we couldn't function without our volunteers, and it's been that way for years. But it's also getting harder and harder to find volunteers that are interested. So yeah, attracting families and having the husband or having the son or having the daughter that isn't necessarily involved in the sport, having them come along and assist is really central to our success. And yeah, again, we wouldn't survive without them.
Absolutely, make a day of it, and all the while striving to keep those entry fees down. But I think this has been very helpful, Rob, in explaining just how it's broken down and where the money goes. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the program. I know that you're going to come on possibly next week again, because you have some news on the Hall of Fame inductees this year, which we're going to be breaking soon, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. And I think there's going to be a lot of familiar faces, and both horse and human, that we're all very excited to see going at the end of the year. So I'm hoping that news comes down the pike soon, and maybe we'll get someone else who's a little more, who's even better on the radio than myself to come and speak to you. But in any case, yeah, that'll be a very exciting announcement.
And in addition to the news, we'll also be featuring another Rolex rookie on the program next week as they prepare for the Rolex Kentucky 3-day event, which takes place at the end of this month. But now, for an event on a smaller scale, we hear from Kelly Maylock from Sundance Farm in Wisconsin. Kelly organized her first event last year, and she joins us to tell us what that involved. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, here you are getting ready for the spring season up there in the frozen north, which hopefully is not too frozen now, but I'm sure you can't wait for spring.
We are counting the days, and every day that it gets above 40, we are pretty excited.
Well, let's talk about what you do there at Sundance Farm, because you own that with your husband. It's quite a large operation, and you took it upon yourselves to host the first event, the first affiliated event there last year. So tell us a little bit about the background of the farm and what you do there.
Well, I've been eventing for 25 years, and my daughters both event with me. And we had just felt that there was a great need in Wisconsin area for for another horse trial. And we ended up purchasing another 40 acres for the farm, so it gave us 100 acres. And it was an old campground, and it just really offered some great terrain. And we felt that we could think about trying to offer something for the people in the area. So we just started pursuing getting Eric Bull to come in and work on where the water hazard would be, where the banks would be, all that sort of stuff, and started getting a rough track going. And then it was a matter of getting to it.
Well, obviously, you're well established there as a business. You're known in the local community. But building that sort of family of volunteers and all that it takes with sponsors and the media and all the organizational bits and pieces that you have to pull together is quite an undertaking. So what made you decide that you really would give it a go? This is something that you wanted to do to promote the farm and get involved with the sport at that level.
I had been talking about it for a number of years, and I had everyone from my daughters to clients to friends and just people in the industry saying, do it, you can do this, you're organized, you can do this. And I bit the bullet and said, all right. I had great support from my husband and the boarders and everyone when it came to constructing jumps. We'd have big days of just jump building after my husband designed the fences and that sort of thing. And we just had so much support from everyone I knew, and then people started coming out of the woodwork, hearing about it on Facebook or whatever, and offering to come up and be jump judges or to donate flowers for the courses or whatever. We just had lots of people say, yay, do this, this is a great idea. I could not have done it without all the people that helped with that sort of thing.
Well, of course, there's the cost implications as well, Kelly. There's raising the sponsorship as much as you can to underwrite the event. How did you go about all that?
Well, let me see. We have a couple clients here that backed me financially, and we also have a couple industries that also backed us. Sargento Foods, which is big in Wisconsin. It's cheese. It's Wisconsin. And they backed us. Our bank offered to sponsor a jump, actually the picture frame jump that people see on a lot of our promotional materials was sponsored by the bank. Local businesses, past clients came forth and just said, yes, we would do that. And I actually had people come up to me after the fact and say, why didn't you ask me? So obviously I'll be asking them this year to sponsor. So granted, we could have used even more sponsors and all that, but we just really had a lot of support from the people in the area.
Now, in terms of the divisions that you were going to run, did you have any guidance there, or did you come up with the ideas of what you would start with? And I'm sure you didn't want to run before you could walk, so how did you put it all together in your own mind?
Well, we had already had probably half the fences here just from us schooling and building jumps over the years. And since a lot of my clients were lower level, we obviously started out at the lower levels. I started just with the beginner novice, the novice, and the training, because that's what we had the most fences for. And that was enough to bite off. In order for me to be the course designer, that was as high as I could go with training anyway, with the certification through the USEA and the course that I had to take through them. So, and that was enough anyway. And that was where I felt a lot of our, in Area 4, that's the divisions that fill. So that was just the wisest route for us to go.
And in terms of entries, did you have obviously an idea locally of what kind of response there would be and how many entries that you could come away with? Was there an overfill there, or did you meet what your expectations were for that first year?
Well, the expectations versus what the hopes were, of course, two different things. We were available to take on 110 horses, and we were told by other people, I had talked to a lot of other horse trials in the area, and they said, basically, your first year, you'll get 50. And I said, okay, I'll take 50 if that's what I have to start with, and it is exactly what we got, was 50 riders. I was a little concerned because our date that we were given of what we could pick from is during the AECs. And so that's always going to be a problem with the people that go down to the AECs or east or west or wherever it always turns up to be. So we knew we weren't going to have a huge amount, but for our first year in running it, 50 was the perfect amount because now we learned more things and we really are set to grow next year. And we got such a great response from the competitors and even the officials that day that told us it is going to grow probably at least double next year. And that's good because I don't really want to jump up to suddenly 200 horses.
And how did it go then? How was that first event for you? Did it meet your expectations? Did you come away at the end of it, you know, and collapse in a comfortable chair with a glass of adult beverage and say, what did I just do? Can we do it again?
Absolutely. We were thrilled to death. I was so pleased with my workers, all my coordinators, my stewards, everyone that helped run it. It was the little glitches that we had were minor. I mean, you're never going to have the perfect horse trial. We were blessed with 70-degree weather, which is just perfect. The colors are beautiful, so that automatically makes all your competitors just in a better, happy frame of mind, even if they have a bad day. But we came off there feeling like, oh my gosh, we really did it. This was awesome. Let's do it again. And not a one of my coordinators or volunteers backed out and said, oh my gosh. They all said, yes, this, now we really know what we have to do. So it should be even more amazing next year.
And how was it received in the local community, Kelly? Because we all know that we'd love to expand the sport, you know, across the community to bring new people into the sport, not just to participate, but also to increase the fan base as well. Did you find you were reaching areas of the community that had otherwise not paid attention to what you're doing at Sundance Farm?
If you're talking equestrian community, we had a good showing and a good support about what I expected. We drew a number of people down from the north. The Upper Peninsula of Michigan is really stuck with where they can go for the horse trials because with all the Great Lakes around there traveling with horses, they can only go south. And so we're one of the more northern horse trials for them. So they were really appreciating that, to have that so much closer. We have more work to do with just the regular spectators and non-horsey people that we would like to come out and spectate and possibly get interested in the horses or the eventing or just supporting this sport in the area. So that's one of our big goals, is to reach out to spectators now.
Now, have you had any interest from the local media? Have they paid attention to what you're doing? Is that an area where you will focus in order to broaden the audience?
Exactly what our plan is. We've gotten much more involved with the local Chamber of Commerce in the two communities. We sit between Plymouth and Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin, and we've now gotten involved with the Chamber of Commerce and are getting more exposure with the businesses so that they realize this is going on. And, yes, getting more articles or attempting to get more articles in local newspapers and that sort of thing so that people know we're here, because unfortunately for eventing, it's kind of a hidden sport. It's not at the local, you know, coliseum or something where people see it as they're driving by. All the horse trials are always kind of tucked in somewhere, so you don't get many unplanned spectators.
What were the biggest challenges for you of hosting your first event?
Well, there were a few times where I wondered if I was insane, and I lost sleep thinking, oh my gosh, I got to do this, and we got to take care of that, and we got to do this, and that was expected, but still, I needed my sleep. There's always little things that come up. It's like you try to have everything as organized as you can, and there's always something that comes up. Suddenly, you know, the porta potties went to the wrong place, or you know, luckily all our judges got here, the flights all came fine, all those really crucial things found a place. But I really had everything organized as if we were going to start running it on Thursday, so that Friday we could handle any crisis or anything that the president of the ground jury or the TD felt needed to be changed. I just kept that whole day to fix anything, because we figured since it was our first time, there was probably all kinds of things they were going to fix. And we ended up moving one jump due to the sun, the way the sun was hitting at that time of day. That was the biggest thing we really had to do
at the last minute. And what was the most fun about doing this when you reviewed it with your family and took a look at the weekend and how it all went? What did you get the biggest satisfaction out of?
There is nothing like watching people come across your cross-country course. There's just nothing like it. I could have cried when I watched the first horse come galloping up to where all the spectators were sitting, and of course was at the water, but the fence before the water, and just the whole thing. It was like, oh my gosh, this is really it. We've really done it. It's really happening. That was a big one for us. The other one that was really a very fond memory is in the Midwest here, because our horse trials tend to be 2 days because of the traveling distance, we had the competitors party at the top of the banks, and it was beautiful weather, and we just had, you know, wine and cheese and fruit and that sort of thing, and just hosted all the volunteers and all the competitors. And what people did was a course walk, and as they come up the banks, which are quite, they're on a hill, so they're very inspiring, awesome, intimidating, any one of those, and they come hiking up the hill ready for their soda or their water or their whatever they were going to have, and they would come up and say, oh my gosh, this is an awesome course. This is beautiful. It is so going to be so much fun. And that was really, that was good enough for me. That was, the volunteers were all just like, oh my gosh, this is so cool.
Now, did you call on the local pony club as well, Kelly?
I did to a point, although I called on them more to get them to come and compete, more so than to work or do things. We actually, 4-H is a big thing up here, and the horse program and the 4-H is pretty big, so we actually hit them up more because they wouldn't be competing. They would be more interested in helping out. So we used the 4-H for some of our background work and tried to get the pony clubbers to come and actually play the game. But that's not how it worked around the country. That just happened to work here.
And the biggest takeaways, the biggest lessons learned for you as you get ready for this year's event?
Oh, boy. That's a hard one. The biggest lesson, I guess, just keep remaining calm, do what you do best, and let it happen, and let's see how we handle it. And if it's not so good, then we will fix it for next year, I guess. I guess that's what I'm going to say. The biggest lesson was get yourself all set and then just let it happen, and hopefully everything's going to fall in place, which it did.
Stay calm and kick on.
Yes, exactly.
Terrific. And remind us all of dates for this year's event, Kelly, and which divisions you'll be running.
Well, we're actually, the other thing I should tell you about is Area 4 does not hold a young event horse qualifier, and we have decided, Tim Holkamp talked me into offering a young event horse qualifier. So that's actually going to be on Friday, September 25th, and then the 26th and 27th of September will be the regular horse trial. And we're also going to try offering the new event horse, which is sort of for and hoping to hit up some of those pony clubbers that aren't quite ready to do a whole horse trial, but they're ready to try a basic dressage test, 5 or 6 stadium jumps, and 5 or 6 cross-country jumps. And we're hoping to try to get more people to try it. It's a little cheaper to do it for them that way, and it's not quite so involved. It's just one day, and they can get their feet wet without really immersing themselves so deeply that they overwhelm themselves. So that's the new thing we're offering there. We are also going to offer a starter novice, because we do have the fences for that. We have the water, we have ditches, we have banks, we have all the things required. So to add that smaller, lower level to try to draw in more of those people is our goal. And then we had various trainers in the area ask if we're going to offer prelim, and we don't have enough fences for prelim, but I said I would offer a prelim training so that they can at least work their way to get up there because we're so late in the season, if someone wants to dabble in that a little bit at the end of the year to get ready for next year at prelim. So that's another one of our big goals.
Well, let's hope you have the perfect weather that you did last year for the event, and the very best of luck with it.
Well, thanks for having me.
And that is the show for this week. Be sure to join us next week when we continue the countdown to this year's Rolex Kentucky 3-day event. Don't forget that this podcast is available for download from the iTunes podcast store to your smartphone or tablet app. And you can then listen to the show on the go. Until next time, thanks for your company and enjoy your eventing.